In 1415, Henry V led the English into battle against the French.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
Shakespeare made Agincourt a legendary victory, England's finest hour.
And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here.
The happy English few beat an army three times its size, a victory against all odds.
Hardly any English were killed for the kind of engagement it was, whereas for the French it was a carnage.
Historians have always put this triumph down to the most feared weapon in Europe, England's trump card, the longbow. But new research is beginning to tell quite a different story. Experts in geology, crowd dynamics, and engineering are piecing together a new picture of what happened in 1415.
The longbow wasn't enough on its own to win the Battle of Agincourt.
So how did such a small English army defeat the overwhelming numbers of the French nobility? In the 14th and 15th centuries, there was intense rivalry between England and France. Throughout the Hundred Years' War, they battled constantly for control of land. At first, the English gained the advantage with decisive victories at Crecy and Poitiers. But by 1415, they were looking back on a generation of defeats. Henry V was the 28-year-old king of England. Although young, he was an experienced warrior. He decided to win back some English pride. Henry started well, taking the northern French port of Harfleur. And as winter approached, he began a victory march back to England. But on his way to Calais, he came face to face with French troops. This was Agincourt. In Henry's way were mostly well-armored knights. The English army was much less well protected, and they were vastly outnumbered. The Battle of Agincourt lasted around 2 hours, and the English won a stunning victory. At day's end, many thousands of French knights lay dead. Victims of the English longbow. This account of what happened at Agincourt has never been challenged, until now.
It's a huge puzzle. So what do you think?
Pretty impressive.
Simon Richardson and Tim Sutherland are battlefield archaeologists and experts in medieval warfare. They're the first people to systematically investigate the terrain of Agincourt. Their detective work involves looking for artifacts, but they also plan to investigate the lie of the land itself.
Agincourt.
For landscape is often crucial to the outcome of a battle. In 600 years, this landscape has changed relatively little. Then, as now, there were three villages, Maisoncelle, Tramcourt, and Agincourt. Between them was the main road. It was along this road that Henry was leading his troops, north to Calais. He found his way blocked by the French army, assembled to the north of Agincourt. Henry set up camp at Maisoncelle. This is the area where the battle took place. Can clues to the English victory be found in the topography of the battlefield itself?
If you look at the contours on the map, they seem to drop off relatively steeply on either side.
Tim and Simon are looking to see if there is anything unusual about its shape.
So from here it looks relatively flat, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's quite deceptive because on the ground looks generally flat, but it drops away there down in towards Drencourt. And again, you can see it dropping off significantly, so only see the top of the church from here. So it obviously drops down into Agincourt.
Yeah.
Although at first sight the battlefield looks wide and flat, Tim and Simon soon discover something intriguing. On either side, the land falls away quite sharply.
I can just see your arms waving up there now.
This means the space for fighting on this deceptively flat field would have been restricted, which could be significant. But just how significant depends on how many men were on the battlefield at Agincourt that day. History records that the English had a much smaller army than the French, but is this an exaggeration, part of the myth of their glorious victory? These original documents record the names of every man who left England to fight with Henry V, and every man who came back.
This is a tremendous role. I mean, it's not only tremendous in what it tells us, but also, as you can see, in its size. It kind of goes on forever.
All the troops who went to Agincourt had their details recorded on one of these medieval muster rolls. From them, Anne Curry can work out how many men fought on the English side.
You could count up all the people on here. In fact, I've started a computer database, but it would be possible for us with this to calculate how many people there were present at Agincourt on the English side, or get pretty close to it.
Anne has calculated that at Agincourt there were around 7,000 on the English side. And these 7,000 English would have faced approximately 20,000 French.
We have similar documents for the French army. We know that a lot of French noblemen died at the Battle of Agincourt. We have tremendous long lists of those who died.
The documents prove that the French army was much bigger. But they also show something else, that the two armies were organized in different ways. Henry's men were paid troops and socially mixed. The French were mostly noblemen. So how did they compare when they came face to face on the morning of October the 25th, 1415? Historian Matthew Bennett is a specialist in medieval tactics.
So there's two very different armies on the battlefield at Agincourt.
The English army, commanded by Henry V in person, with dismounted men-at-arms.
These are the heavily equipped knights.
And on the flanks, archers, positioned so they could shoot at the advancing French. On the other side, Charles VI. Well, where's he? Well, he's not actually at the battlefield because he's insane.
So we have to discount him. Their formation...
Well, they've got some missile men as well, in front of the forces, flanked by cavalry, whose job was to attack the English archers and drive them away. And then a mass of the heavy fighting infantry, dismounted men-at-arms, rank upon rank upon rank upon rank of them, outnumbering the English anywhere between 3 and 5 to 1.
From the moment the English set foot on the field, the odds were stacked against them. Confronted by heavily armed French nobles in much greater numbers, how could Henry possibly hope to win this encounter? On the morning of the 25th of October, 1415, Henry V's 7,000 men prepared to face 20,000 French on the battlefield of Agincourt. Legend has it they would stand up to a formidable cavalry charge and mow it down with a hail of arrows. In their hands, a super weapon, the longbow. Powerful and deadly even at long range, it has been called the machine gun of the Middle Ages. But did Henry have enough archers in his small army to create this arrow storm? It's now possible to calculate exactly how many of these super weapons Henry actually had. Sir Thomas Erpingham was the man who gave the orders to release the famous hail of arrows. Like all Henry's men, he had to pay for every single man and piece of equipment he took with him on campaign.
Perhaps one of the most fascinating sources that we have for the Battle of Agincourt are sort of little bags like this one here, made, I think, out of sheepskin with it sort of shaved off, like a sort of dolly bag. And we have a whole array of documents concerning Sir Thomas Erpingham's service at Agincourt.
Amongst the documents Sir Thomas kept is this one, the actual contract he signed with King Henry, which still has the royal seal. The contract shows how many of each type of soldier Sir Thomas agreed to bring on the campaign.
And we can see on here that Sir Thomas was to bring along 2 knights, 17 esquires, or men-at-arms probably, as we see them described in other sources, and 60 archers.
Anne has worked out precisely how many English archers there would have been and how many men-at-arms, heavily equipped knights, fighting on foot. The comparison is surprising. The English army was composed of 5,500 archers and only 1,500 men-at-arms. Had Henry taken a gamble on having so few men-at-arms, because he thought the longbow men were the best troops? After studying these documents, Anne thinks there might be another reason.
We can see the sums of money that the troops got. Here we've got Sir Thomas himself as 4 shillings a day, his men-at-arms each 12 pence a day, and then 60 archers at 6 pence a day, VI a day.
The records tell us the archers were a bargain, 2 for the price of a single knight. But they also reveal something else. Henry was so short of money that he pawned the crown jewels of England to pay for his war.
Being cynical, I would say that probably the main reason is that archers were cheaper. He wanted to make a very big show in France in 1415. The only way of getting an army that was strong was to increase the proportion of archers in it.
So Henry's army was mostly made up of archers, but they were there because they were cheap, not because of their skill. So what was it about the longbow that gave these men the power to overcome vastly superior numbers?
It's a very simple weapon to use. You draw your bow back, the full draw, then the energy stored in that bow is tremendous.
The secret of the longbow's power lies in what it's made of, a unique combination of 2 types of wood growing naturally within a single tree, the yew. On the outside, the elastic sapwood. On the inside, the rigid heartwood.
The heartwood on its own would break, but the sapwood is a tension wood, in other words, a stretchy wood, and the sapwood stops the heartwood from breaking.
The longbow is not only easy to use. It also has a quality that could help a small army make up for a shortage in numbers.
The archers would have had what I would call ready arrows. They were shooting off anywhere between 8 to 12 arrows in a minute. As long as they can do that, they can put this blanket firepower down.
What gave the longbow its crucial advantage was the speed with which it could be shot. It was 4 times as fast to reload as other weapons of the time, such as the French crossbow.
The longbow is not an accurate weapon as such. It's a weapon of mass firepower. You're pushing as many arrows over as you can and causing as much havoc as possible.
There were 5,500 English archers, each loosing an average of 10 arrows a minute. So in the opening moments of the Battle of Agincourt, 55,000 English arrows would have rained down on the French knights. Henry's archers could clearly create a storm of arrows, but what damage did these arrows do when they reached their targets? Was an arrow of the time powerful enough against armor of the time? To test this, we need evidence. After 4 days metal detecting on the battlefield, Simon Richardson has found what he's been looking for. An arrowhead he is convinced was shot by one of the English longbows.
I believe this is probably a short bodkin. I think it would have been quite a bit longer, probably nearly the same size again.
X-rays make clear that this arrowhead is indeed the classic type that would have been shot by the English archers at Agincourt, the bodkin point. If the longbow was the machine gun of the Middle Ages, this was its bullet.
This is a bodkin, a long tapering point that actually does the penetrating, and there's a socket here which the arrowhead goes into.
The bodkin point was made out of iron.
An arrow will only be used once. The chances of you getting it back are actually slim. And so it doesn't make sense that you make arrows out of very expensive steel.
Its unique shape had a particular purpose.
The difference with a bodkin is that you have actually less resistance because of its shape, so it will actually make a deeper wound. Popular myth has it that this was designed specially for penetrating armour.
The French knights would certainly have been wearing armour, though none has ever been found at Agincourt. But one rare artifact from the battlefield does give a clue to how the French knights were equipped. This is a spur. It must have been lost by a French knight in the heat of the battle. Tim and Simon can deduce how good his armour would have been.
That is the most elaborate spur I've ever seen. I think these are all these crisscross marks, they're fish scales.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the scales going down the body and then the tail of the merman. Half man, half fish.
I mean, look at the size of the roll. I've never seen one quite that big before. It's quite a ferocious-looking thing, isn't it? A bit like a status symbol, I think. The bigger the roll, the bigger the man. A really, really wealthy person's spur.
Yeah, so this is such an elaborate piece of equipment. Then the armour that went with this spur would be very, very extravagant and very beautiful.
The spur confirms that there were very rich nobles on the battlefield. They would have been wearing the best protection money could buy. So what type of armor would have been available to them at the time, and how effective would it have been?
In order to find out whether armor made a knight invulnerable or not, depends first of all on analyzing what it's made of.
Alan Williams has made a special study of the medieval armor at the Wallace Collection. He can date each piece in the collection by analyzing the metal.
You can see from the crystalline structure there that this is in fact a medieval iron. But medieval iron will make armor, but armor of the lowest quality. An armour that will tend to break easily if it's attacked.
This helmet was made between 1350 and 1400. But when Alan looks at armour made just a few years later, there is a dramatic change in the quality of its metal. Alan has discovered that in the Middle Ages, there was an arms race. and the Battle of Agincourt took place at a crucial turning point, the moment of a major advance in metal technology.
This is a gauntlet for the left hand. If we look at the microstructure of this piece of armour, we see that it's completely different to the iron helmet because it is in fact steel.
Steel, a new metal for a new age. The composition of steel makes it tougher and stronger. This was a vast improvement on iron.
This is a visor made in a few years before Agincourt, and a great many knights would have been wearing something like this.
The knights at Agincourt were top French nobles. It's almost certain they would have been wearing steel armor. Would this have stopped arrowheads like the one from the battlefield? New technology can put this to the test. With a high-speed camera, the energy of an arrow leaving a longbow can be accurately calculated. A Bodkin arrow weighing 63 grams records a speed of 37.9 meters per second. The energy arrived at in mathematical terms is 38 joules. To see what would have happened when a Bodkin point met armor, this result is fed into a high impact machine. It recreates the crucial moment. At the receiving end, a piece of 2 millimeter thick mild steel, equivalent to the metal of the day. Although Henry's archers and the French knights are long gone, 600 years later, a Bodkin point once again tries to penetrate armor. And fails. The weaker English Bodkin arrow simply buckles when it hits the steel. There is no way it would have gone through French armor. So the mounted knights coming towards Henry's archers would have been very unlikely to have been killed or even injured by arrows from the longbow. Moreover, the legendary use of the longbow and the hail of arrows only account for the opening minutes of the battle. The fighting at Agincourt continued for another 2 hours. The longbow simply could not have been the decisive weapon history has claimed.
The French had the English in their hands, and they thought they were going to just roll the English up. It was as simple as that.
The French still outnumbered the English 3-1. So the mystery is perhaps not why did the English win at Agincourt, but how on earth did the French lose? The French army that faced the English on this field 600 years ago was made up of the cream of the nobility. Their armor gave them good protection against the longbow. And leading their attack, they had the best armed of all knights, the cavalry. These should have given them the opening advantage. And the tens of thousands of men on foot following them should have finished the job. But 2 hours later, there would be piles of French dead up to 6 foot high. Understanding what happened at Agincourt is not a question of working out how the English won, but how the French could have lost. A rare find might shed light on this. A remarkable document written 10 days before Agincourt. This is the original French battle plan. It survives as just one sheet of a burnt manuscript, but it details exactly what tactics and formations the French intended to use.
It's on a much damaged document, just a small scrap, really, written in French, probably at the command of the French leader of the advance guard, Marshal Boucicault, and it shows that the French had a way in which they could have defeated the English.
The French king was not on the battlefield. Gripped by insanity, he thought he was made of glass. But his army was in the capable hands of a trusted military tactician, Marshal Boucicault.
The point is that with an experienced and competent commander, the French were quite capable of beating the English as long as they learnt to use their crossbowmen, their men-at-arms and their cavalry in effective combination.
Boucicault's plan was to do just that and deliver a knockout blow at the beginning of the battle. With cavalry and the crossbow, he would surprise and disperse the English archers. But on the day, something clearly went wrong.
The crossbowmen, for example, well, they just got pushed into the back rank, so they never played a part. The French cavalry charges launched on both flanks were supposed to be several hundred strong, attacked on both flanks. But not everybody seems to have turned up to do the job.
The few that did charge failed to make an impact on the English lines. And without the protection of the crossbows, the horses stopped being the most powerful thing on the field and became the most vulnerable. Although knights were protected with the latest armor, horses were not. A horse could be badly wounded by an arrow, and if its rider were thrown, it would have a catastrophic knock-on effect. The volatile horses began to retreat, but by now the French knights on foot were already advancing behind them towards the English lines. The inevitable happened. Chaos.
The problem with the French plan, when applied to Agincourt, that it had been designed by an experienced military man, but it was put into operation by a mass of rival noblemen who either didn't understand it or weren't capable of organising it.
On the day, Boucicault's sensible military tactics were not implemented. He was overruled by the senior nobles on the field. And the reason this happened goes to the heart of why men went to battle in the Middle Ages. To make money.
You would have thought twice before killing someone of rank. They would not normally have been killed in cold blood.
This was an age when there was a code of conduct in battle. Most of the French army were nobles hoping to make their money out of ransom. They wouldn't always kill an enemy, for he might be worth something.
This was a kind of investment, and indeed some people, I think, when they went to war, did gain a lot. It's like winning the national lottery. You could take one very important prisoner and live off that ransom for the rest of your life.
To take someone ransom, it was important to be able to identify who was who on the battlefield. And most importantly, to know what they were worth. But in the heat of battle, how could people tell? This was the reason for heraldry.
These signs and symbols, the banners also, were crucial. The French coming in from the other side would be seeing the various banners of the king and the other sub-companies and no doubt aiming for where they thought the richest prizes lay in terms of ransom.
Ransom was inextricably linked with heraldry. And by reducing the combat to these signs and symbols, it's possible to read the battlefield as the French would have done 600 years ago. By now, the French had advanced to the English lines.
The French knights, the nobles, the men-at-arms, each one of these has a name, a title, a coat of arms, which marks them out
as socially significant. But the French obsession with fighting men of equal rank and taking the king and the men-at-arms means that they don't really take full account of the archers. The French noblemen didn't feel that they were proper soldiers at all. A blank. That's how they were regarded.
So was the French drive for ransom the key to what went wrong at Agincourt? Heraldry shows that when the French reached the thick of the fighting, they were in for a shock. Facing them was an English army that consisted mostly of archers. In heraldic terms, the archers were blanks, worthless for ransom.
Imagine their surprise then amongst the French when the archers actually came out from behind their stakes and began to attack their social superiors.
Take it!
Not only were the archers worth nothing, they also cared nothing for the nobles' code. They were just desperate to win the battle.
The point about archers is that they are very flexible soldiers. They can turn their hands to anything. The chroniclers tell us that the archers climb in and stab people in the neck. And they used strange weapons that the archers have, which are effectively lead hammers that go clunk on somebody's helmet.
So the archers did start to do some damage, killing far more men with daggers and hammers than they did with the longbow. This breakdown in battle etiquette left the French in disarray. But can this socially caused confusion have been enough on its own to have brought about the French downfall? After all, the French still vastly outnumbered the English and were better armed. On the battlefield, Tim and Simon have continued to explore the terrain to see if there is any truth in contemporary accounts. These say the ground was sodden from recent rain, and the French fell over in the mud. In their armour, they couldn't get up again, and suffocated to death.
Seems quite dry already.
So does the actual soil of Agincourt hold the key to understanding the French downfall?
So basically it's the subsoil we're after.
To reach the battlefield of 600 years ago, Tim and Simon have to dig down nearly a metre below today's surface. On the face of it, this doesn't look like a soil that would get particularly muddy when wet.
It sticks together quite well, but it's too crumbly.
Yeah, it breaks up easily, doesn't it?
Yeah. We'll fill that up and then that should be enough.
The sample is sent to Cambridge University to be tested.
This is a piece of soil from Agincourt. First sight, there's nothing very special about it. If you were to walk on this soil when it were dry, that would be quite straightforward. Your feet wouldn't dig in much and it wouldn't stick to you. But it is actually a little unusual when you pour water on it, because what you see is that the water soaks in. It doesn't run off as it would if it were a piece of solid clay. It doesn't run through as it would if it were sand. What's unusual is that it runs into the pores and stays in the soil.
How muddy a soil will get depends on the size of its particles and the space between them. The Agincourt soil is deceptive.
And so though this lump looks dry on the outside, it's actually got a lot of water in it. And then that means that if you squidge it about, as horses' hooves or soldiers' feet might do, it rather rapidly turns into a rather thick and sticky mud that would stick to people and horses. And we think that's significant and unusual.
Following heavy rain, this particular soil would have become unusually muddy. In a laboratory, it's possible to replicate the conditions on the day of the battle.
Bit more, perhaps.
This will show whether, as the French advanced through the mud, it was the weight of their heavy armour that proved their biggest problem. A machine pushes armour plate into this mud. and it measures the energy that would be required to pull it out again. It seems a knight, trying to pull his armored foot out of the mud, would have felt as if he had 15 bags of sugar fixed to his ankle. But surprisingly, this was nothing to do with the weight of the armor.
If you fell over in this sticky soil and tried to get up, the main thing preventing you from getting up would be the suction effect of the stickiness of the soil. And that would be much more important than the weight of the armor you were wearing.
The crucial factor is suction, regardless of weight. It's because the metal is smooth, rigid, and non-porous that it sticks so fast in the mud of Agincourt.
The attempt to move the plate away from the soil creates a reduced pressure in the tiny spaces between the soil particles. And it generates a big suction force which would impede a soldier.
But possibly it didn't impede all soldiers equally. Though all were fighting in the same mud, the English soldiers were not for the most part wearing armor. They were wearing cloth. Could this have worked in their favor?
When we use the Instron machine to push into the soil plate covered with cloth, then we find it comes out much more easily. The suction effect is hugely reduced. That's because it can peel away at one place at a time.
With cloth, the suction force is much lower. So ironically, the lightly clad archers would have been better able to fight on this battlefield than the well-armored knights. But to explain such a huge death toll in the French ranks requires one final bit of detective work. And it goes back to the shape of the battlefield itself. Modern contour information from the Agincourt area has been used to create a 3D model. What new light will this shed on the topography for Tim and Simon?
Oh, wow, look at this. It's impressive, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's broad and flat in this area.
Yeah.
And then it definitely narrows into this tight piece of land, and then this distinct funnel by the crossroads. And then what happens is the land falls away significantly on either side of this large spine, and it remains narrow. But it is like a very large funnel, isn't it?
It's
broad at the top and narrow, and then stays narrow as it goes down this piece of land.
The map brings the shape of the battlefield into sharp relief. The English had made their lines in the narrow end of the battlefield. As the French advanced towards them from the broad, flat plains in the north, they were drawn into a funnel. Looking at the design of any space, like this underground station, Keith Still can run a computer program that shows him how a crowd would behave in an emergency. He has applied this software to the Agincourt battlefield.
My immediate reaction was that there was a space that went from 773 metres down to approximately 350 metres. So there's a 50% reduction in the overall area.
With the computer model running, the effect of the funnel on the crowd is all too clear.
Here we have a model of a funnel, and we're moving these soldiers from right to left. You can see very clearly, this funnel effect has actually got quite a dramatic effect. They're all trying to push towards the centre. So we see the ranks starting to break up. Chaos and confusion would have started. Now, this is just a normal movement of people through a funnel.
When Keith takes account of the actual circumstances on the battlefield that day, the results are dramatic.
What I've done here now is I've factored in the effects of people stumbling in the mud. So very quickly, the crowd is crushing, concertinaing up into a complete bottleneck. And here we have people pushing in from the back, people unable to move at the front. It only takes five people pushing against one before you can collapse lungs, break ribs. This is all the classic makings of a crowd disaster. too many people, a very quick reduction in the overall space, a massive increase in density, a sudden reduction in the forward movement, one or two people tripping in the very thick mud, the conditions that we're working under, and you have a disaster on your hands.
Even without the English archers and their hammers and knives, the French, squeezed onto the narrow battlefield, would have suffered heavy losses.
The losses at Agincourt potentially had very little to do with the fighting. If you look at the history of crowd disasters, you can see every element of every worst disaster combined in this one single environment.
What has always been seen as a great English victory turns out to have been more of a catastrophic French failure. In the end, there had simply been too many Frenchmen. This had brought chaos to the field, and many had died without even engaging in fighting. But there is one final twist in the Agincourt story.
One of the most remarkable things about the Battle of Agincourt is the imbalance of dead on each side. Hardly any English were killed for the kind of engagement it was, whereas for the French it was a carnage.
Many French knights survived the crowd disaster, and they should have survived the battle.
You would have expected many of those men to have been taken prisoner. And it was a sort of fair tradition of the Hundred Years' War to take prisoners.
The contemporary accounts tell us that at the end of the battle, hundreds of Frenchmen were indeed taken prisoner by Henry. They were entirely at the mercy of the English. They should have been taken back to England and ransomed. But King Henry now gave dramatic orders to kill them in cold blood.
One French source says that the nobles on the English side were reluctant to kill the French prisoners, and thus men of lower rank had to be sent in to do the job. The reason that is given for reluctance to kill the prisoners is nothing to do with humanitarianism, it is to do with the loss of ransom.
Despite the nobles' reluctance, the prisoners were put to death. The English archers were only too ready to execute Henry's orders. So it was the longbowmen, after all, who played the final part in England's victory, the slaughter of hundreds of French prisoners of war.
It is interesting to speculate that that is why the numbers of dead at Agincourt were so high. These weren't men killed in the battle. They were men, I suppose you could say, murdered.
So is the heroic Henry V of Shakespeare a sham? Was Henry, in fact, a brutal war criminal? Anne Curry thinks not.
We know that he won the Battle of Agincourt, but at that stage in the battle, he wasn't too sure. He had so many French taken prisoner, I think he couldn't take the risk of these men within his ranks who could at any moment perhaps attack from the rear. So these people had to be killed.
The killing of the prisoners was the act of a commander not yet confident that he had taken the day. The English did win the Battle of Agincourt, and with this victory, Henry secured his place in history. But it was not the noble victory of a charismatic leader and his skillful longbowmen. It was a victory snatched from chaos by an English king ruthless enough to take his chance, whatever the cost.